Welcome to Death Holler, Season 5, When Bad Animals Go Bad. With your hosts, the Reverend Dr. Death and Lyraina. This season will include love.
Do you know how your husband died?
Oh, yes. I killed him.
Transformations. And certified good boys and girls.
Good Joe. What are you growling at?
Remember, when you're in Death Holler, listener discretion is always advised.
Perfect, go bad, dang!
Everyone, and welcome back to Death Holler. I'm your host, Reverend Dr. Death. Joining me as always, my co-host, Lyraina, and we are discussing probably the most famous animals attack film that anybody knows of, for and rightfully so, Jaws from 1975. Tagline, you'll never go in the water again.
I mean, it works. I haven't looked at any of the other taglines yet, but it's pretty straightforward, which I like that, because sometimes they just go off and you're like, that has nothing to do with this film.
There's basically one that I saw that tells like a fucking story or something.
Oh, I hate those.
And they do this. Yeah. Directed by Steven Spielberg, who even knows who that guy is.
Never heard of him.
Written by Peter Benchley and Carl Gottlieb, who did the screenplay, and based upon the novel by Peter Benchley, which I did not know, but apparently it was a book before it was a movie. Music by John Williams.
Never heard
probably
of
him. Probably the most famous composer ever. I mean, my favorite thing by him, I had a recent discussion with at work over this, was that probably the Jurassic Park theme's always playing in a tab, open tab in my head constantly.
Oh, God.
But, you know, made for a budget of $9 million US, it made $260 million domestically and $470 million worldwide, and that was back in 1975. So, you
barely
know,
it made its money back. Oh,
yeah.
My God, this film barely did it.
Principal players, we have Roy Scheider playing Brody, who is the sheriff and recent transplant to the area. He was in The French Connection, and he was in Jaws 2. Richard Dreyfuss plays Hooper, who's the marine biologist. I have a hard time with this movie, even though, like, I see the comedy in it because of who's in it, but what about Bob? Have you ever saw that movie?
Oh, yeah.
It's got Bill Murray. Man, I have a hard time watching that movie because, like, I get so mad for Richard Dreyfuss in that movie that I have a hard time watching it.
You know what? That's when you know the actors are doing their job, because Richard Dreyfuss plays such an irritated man. He is being taken such advantage of. And Bob, you know, we know who that is, you know.
Yeah.
If anyone's ever heard of Bill Murray.
He was also in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which was the movie that Spielberg made after this, whenever he said that his next movie was definitely going to be land-based, and so he made that movie afterward.
Okay.
Robert Shaw plays Quint, who is the former soldier and grizzled fisherman in the movie. Actually, he hunts sharks for a living, I think is what he does. He was in The Sting, and he was an old-time actor, so he was in a movie called A Man for All Seasons, one of his bigger films. But he was in a ton of stuff, like a lot of movie versions of Shakespeare plays and stuff like that. He died at 51.
Oh, wow.
He died 3 years after this movie was made of a heart attack.
Damn.
Lorraine Gray plays Ellen Brody, the loving but misguided wife who keeps trying to tell Brody that the water's fine, even though it clearly ain't. And he's the one that came out in the end as being the one that was right about it, whether, I mean, you know, that's a good thing or not. She was also in Jaws 2 and Jaws the Revenge, which is these movies really go down in quality after the first one, folks. Yeah. I mean, they do. And then we have Murray Hamilton playing Vaughn, who is the despicable politician who keeps the Amity shores open, despite the fact that there is a shark killing people, because it will affect the town's money that they'll be getting for the season. So, boo-hoo, you know.
4th of July, Cuatro de Julio, you know.
He was also in Jaws 2 and The Graduate. So, the synopsis... It's Jaws, a small island. I mean, everybody knows it. It's a small island community starts losing its shit when a killer shark begins terrorizing its waters and a greedy politician fucks this over, as they tend to do. Three very different men have to venture out in the ocean to take on the terrible beast and hope they don't die in the process. That's the movie.
I mean, yeah. And the podcast is over, folks. Thank you.
Thank you. You've heard it all. Other taglines. Amity Island had everything. This is the one that's forever. Amity Island had everything. Clear skies, gentle surf, warm water. People flocked there every summer. It was the perfect feeding ground.
I'm so glad they didn't use this.
That sounds like what would be on the back of a book, book synopsis, which would be fine, but not for a movie. The nation's number one best-selling novel is now the year's most terrifying movie.
I didn't even know this was a book. I'm going to be honest with you.
Nobody did. And I mean, and that would describe a Stephen King movie more than it would Jaws, in my opinion. But, on the Cuatro of Julio, or the 4th of July, fishing season will open on you.
I mean, I get it, but it doesn't now.
If you forgot what terror was like, it's back.
No, because that makes it sound like this is like a sequel.
See what you missed the first time after you closed your eyes. I guess that was for like the DVD or something, or the second showing of the movie or something. This one's just as bad. There is a creature alive today which has survived millions of years of evolution without change, without passion, without logic. It lives to kill, a mindless eating machine. It will attack and devour anything. Try to imagine meeting the devil with Jaws.
I'm going home.
You see why I picked the one that I picked. I mean, there is a great white man-eating shark hanging around these parts. That's literally that's the tagline for the movie.
Does he discriminate? He only eats the white man?
Yeah. Great white man, or white man-eating shark. Yeah.
Oh, he only eats great white men. Okay, my bad.
Yeah. The terrifying motion picture from the terrifying number one bestseller. All right. When the beaches open this summer, you will be taken. Mm. That has an implication that only Dennis on It's Always Sunny would approve of.
Yeah.
If you would get my meaning on that.
Yes. I was like, this could be taken in different kind of context.
She was the first. Who will be next? I'm assuming they're talking about the woman who dies at the beginning of the movie.
Don't know that until you've seen the movie.
Yeah, so I don't even know how that's good. Do you like fish? Well, he likes you too. What?
So stupid.
If you want to survive fishing season, don't go in the water.
That's better.
That's better. See it before you go swimming.
Yes. Yes.
quotes. Brody, the most famous quote from this movie, you're going to need a bigger boat.
Oh, yeah. And this was back when movies had good voice actors. Like, they didn't just pick any actor. The actors had great voices, too.
Yeah. Roy Scheider, is so good in this movie. Brody, and this, people know this line because there's a production company that used this at the end of their TV shows all the time. That's some bad head, Harry. I mean, there's a production company that used that all the time. I remember hearing it. I don't remember what shows it was even on. I want to feel like House maybe had that. Could be wrong.
I don't remember.
Quint, here's the swimming with bow-legged women.
What the fuck?
And then Hooper, boys, oh boys, I think he's coming back for his noon feeding. All right. Movie review time. Visually. Now, most people think that the shark's in the movie for longer than it is. That the shark is not shown very much in this movie for good reason, because they couldn't get the fucking prop to work properly. Yes. So, but having said that, considering the fact that everybody thinks that the shark is all over this movie, I would say that visually it did its job.
Yeah, and I, again, as I've mentioned, I've been to Universal many times. I think I've been to the Universal Studios out here at least 20 times already now, in general, in my lifetime, at least 20 times. And I have been attacked by Bruce so many times, but we get to drive right through Amityville because they still have the water area, if you will, where it's open. Yeah. And it, I was showing Taylor a scene, and I said, I can't believe this was filmed on that tiny body of water with just a background, a backdrop behind it. It looks like they're in the fucking ocean.
That's probably because most of the movie was not filmed at Universal Studios. Okay. That's in the trivia. Spielberg fucked up thinking that if he wanted to look realistic, he had to film in the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
Caused him a lot of issues, and then he said if he had it to do over again, he would have filmed in a lake somewhere, yeah, which would have been way easier to do.
Well, Universal Studios has a man-made one, and they showed scenes that were filmed on that particular area,
yeah,
with Jaws, which I know not all of them were. There were scenes you definitely have to have, the ocean. But the ones with Bruce didn't have to be.
No, and the other part of, and that's the other thing. They lost their very first version of Bruce to the bottom of the ocean because it sank. If they would have had it on a soundstage at Universal Studios, they could have just retrieved it.
Could you imagine? Like, so they haven't gone back to look for that? Like, did they ever go get it?
I don't think they did.
So there was just a rusted fucking Bruce at the bottom of some ocean somewhere. That's fucking creepy as fuck.
It's outside of Martha's Vineyard. That's where they filmed most of the main movie at.
That's creepy. That's like the lake that has Jason
Voorhees. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would perish.
Despite what Marty says in Back to the Future Part 2, the shark does not look fake. I feel like even in high definition, because Universal, you can say what you want to. They do their big movies right when they make them in the 4K. They look like brand new fucking movies that have never like aged a day. I saw like their newest version of this, the 50th anniversary of this. That was, I think it's the same one they used for the 40th, but regardless, spotless 4K. I mean, the movie looks brand fucking new. Like there's nothing wrong with them. I mean, it is as good as you're ever going to get, like picture quality wise. That shark looks amazing, even with, you know, increased clarity, which is the problem you have whenever you go back and you do movies and shitty CGI. Like, for instance, and I don't know if we'll remove this or review this movie this season because everything's been truncated, but Deep Blue Sea, that movie got a 4K upgrade. And let me tell you, the CGI in that fucking movie is bad.
Yeah.
It was real bad. But they used actual prop shark in this, and it, kudos to them because the shark stands up over time. So, the story is basically Moby Dick. And anybody who is involved in the process admitted it. I mean, you had Quint, who's Captain Ahab. I mean, you had Brody, I think was Ishmael, and like Hooper's one of the other characters. And they're going out to hunt. And originally, even the guy who is, this is in the trivia, the guy who was making the first version of Jaws before Spielberg was the one that was given the director rights to it. He actually was having them hunt a whale instead of a shark, even though the book is based upon a great white. And that's part of the reason why they kicked him off of the movie, because they were like, dipshit, this movie's about a shark, not a whale. And they was like, get the fuck out of here, you know? So,
yeah.
But it's one of those basic, I mean, some people have likened it to be like kind of a slasher type movie. I mean, just with a shark. And I can't really argue with that, because especially with the POV scenes that Spielberg used to get away from the fact that he didn't have an operating shark, it really does give you the vibe of like being behind Jason's mask and watching him stalk like his prey or whatever at times. So, I mean, it's not too dissimilar from a slasher in that right. But the story is pretty basic. I mean, you know, you have this island being attacked, you know, we went through it. Everybody knows what the story is, but like having the three main characters go out to sea to fight it at the end is like the major hero moment.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that. Acting, especially of the three mains, Shaw, Scheider, and then Richard Dreyfuss. There's a reason why they were all well-known actors. I mean, the guy they were fucking great at what they did.
Yeah.
I mean,
that they all had three different personalities and were put together in one scene.
Yeah, like Quint And this is funny because this is in the trivia. Quint and, you know, Robert Shaw and Hooper or Dreyfus are about as far apart in the movie as you can be. Now, like, you know, you got Brody in the middle, who's kind of like an everyman. But then you got those two. One's like an educated, like, college man. The other one's just like this old grizzled soldier who's just like, you know, lived his life out on the sea.
Yeah.
They those two hated each other because they were so far apart from one another. And in real life, Robert Shaw had the same exact response to Richard Dreyfuss as his character did, where he was always challenging him to shit off, you know, like whenever they were off this, you know, filming, you know, from filming the movie.
Yeah.
It was like, if you're such a big man, won't you drop and give me 10 push-ups? And then Dreyfuss turned around and tried to be a big man and said, well, I'll give you 20. And then Scheider, who was like a former boxer before he became, you know, according to the trivia, looked at Dreyfuss and said, son, 20 is hard for somebody who's a seasoned, you know, athlete. He said, you sure as hell ain't going to be doing 20 push-ups. So it's like they had this, they had the same kind of dynamic off screen as they did on.
That's so funny.
But acting's great. I mean, and then of course the music from John Williams, that, you know, that da da da, you know, like that whole shark. I mean, it's iconic.
And everybody knows that music. That doesn't get lost in the film. You know how you'll watch a film and you'll be like, we'll watch a movie and I'll be like, I didn't notice it.
Oh, you said it several times on this podcast. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is one soundtrack. You hear it. It's there. You don't, and I'm not just talking about the main song, like the whole movie, everything's good.
Yeah. I mean, it's John Williams. I mean, like iconic Star Wars. I mean, he did the Close Encounters of the Third Kind. He did the music for Indiana Jones. He did the music for Jurassic Park. I mean, which is my favorite that he did of all of them. But I mean, now we've gave Elfman his credit where it was due for having good sound, you know, scores.
Yes.
But I'm being perfectly honest in saying that Elfman, outside of a few different movies, sounds samey. When you hear it, you're like, mm-hmm. Oh, that's Danny Elfman.
Yep.
John Williams was so good that, like, if you hear like the original Superman soundtrack, and you compare it to Jurassic Park, they don't even sound like the same person made them.
No.
So, I mean, you got to give credit where credit's due. The man was good at what he did. So, anything you want to say about the movie before, I mean, I figured we'd save anything we want to save for like review, but like before we get into trivia,
no,
there's a lot of trivia.
You got like 20 pages of trivia.
I might just blast through, you know, quick as I can. Cause I shortened this down from like, and I was like, oh, this is interesting. And I might skip some of this.
Trivia is hard. Cause when I've ever done my notes, it's hard to trim trivia.
Yeah, I mean, with some of it gets, you're like, well, that's pretty interesting. And then you get to other stuff. It's just like the gun he used with a 308. It's like, I don't give two shits about that. Just look it. On.
Here's the thing. We blasted through the general premise of the movie. We're at only 18 minutes. So we've got time to go through trivia.
Yeah. Well, that's what most people want to hear anyways on this, because everybody knows about Jaws. Honestly. And our review is going to be mainly, you know, whatever we liked about it and all that stuff. Anyway, so that'll take up its own portion.
Yeah.
So speaking of John Williams, when he originally played the score for director Steven Spielberg, Spielberg actually laughed and said, that's funny, John, really, but what do you have in mind for the theme of Jaws? That's what Spielberg told him. And then he later said that without the score, the movie wouldn't have been one half as successful. So
yeah,
he came around to the fact it's like, okay, that you know, that whole shark theme worked. I mean, it did what it was supposed to do.
I bet you feel so dumb, Spielberg.
He felt dumb for a lot of reasons. We'll get into that during the trivia. Like, the man went through hell during this movie.
Oh, yeah.
Jaws opened on June 20th, 1975. It was supposed to be released in theaters for Christmas 1974. And this is weird. Okay, so you know how the summer blockbuster is a thing now? Like, if you really want a movie to do well, you release it in the summer. This movie is the reason for that. This fucking movie is the reason for that, because every other movie up to that point you released at Christmas, because that's when people were off work and would go out to the movies. Nobody went out to watch movies during the summer, because back then they wanted to be outside and enjoying it, because they didn't realize the sun was killing them.
Wow.
So this movie got dumped in the middle of the summer, and everybody's like, oh, it's just going to go to hell. No, people started watching it and they were like, and this is fucking good. And this movie, because it made so much fucking money in the summer, created the summer blockbuster.
I mean, okay, hear me out. It could be a shitty movie, but it is blistering outside. You're inside with some nice, delicious popcorn. The AC is fucking blasting. And you got an ice cold drink. It doesn't get any better than that.
It doesn't now, but apparently before AC was common, people wanted to be outside enjoying the summer before it got cold. So, Scheider stated in an interview that the scene where Lee Farrow, Mrs. Kenter, smacks him in the face, she was actually hitting him.
Oh, nice.
Because she couldn't fake a slap. And by the 17th time that she slapped him, he said that it was some of the most painful shit he had ever endured in his acting career. He also stated that in several of the takes, she slapped the glasses right off his face. three mechanical Bruces were made. Each with specialized functions. One shark was open on the right side, one was open on the left side, and the third was fully skinned. And each one of them cost $250,000, which back then was a lot of fucking money.
That's a lot of fucking money. Where are the Bruces now? Do you have trivia on that?
I think it does say at some point where at least one of them's at. Okay. I think the second one is at Universal out in Hollywood, the one that you've seen.
Oh, the one that attacks me and scares the
Bruce
shit out of me.
Yeah, Bruce 2 is officially one of those.
That's really cool because he goes through like some gasoline and then somebody shoots at him and flames go up. So when he attacks you, there's flames. You can feel it and it's every time. It's amazing.
Yeah, it sucks so bad that they removed it from the one in Orlando. Man. by the way, the reason he's named Bruce is because that was the name of Steven Spielberg's lawyer. And he wanted the connotation to be, you know, the same, that lawyers were like sharks.
Yeah.
So. During pre-production, Steven Spielberg brought his friends Martin Scorsese, George Lucas, and John Milius to the effects shop where they had the 25-foot-long Bruce, the shark, was being constructed. George Lucas said, if you can get half of this on film, you'll have the biggest hit of all time. And then he stuck his head in the shark's mouth to see how it worked. As a joke, Milius and Spielberg snuck the controls and then tried to clamp it shut on his head. Unfortunately, and rather prophetically, considering the fact of how much trouble they would have with that fucking shark later on, it malfunctioned and they got Lucas stuck in its fucking mouth.
Oh, my God.
After they got him free, the three men ran out of the workshop because Milius later said, we knew we'd broken something expensive.
Oh.
So you just imagine George Lucas walking up there. It's like, hey, Steven, this is going to be great. You know, I'm going to look inside of its mouth. And then he just, you know.
Gets his head stuck.
Although Steven Spielberg considered Charlton Heston for the role of Brody, both Heston and Universal Studios showing great interest. The main reason he decided against Heston was because he was too heroic in all the movies he'd been in up to that point. He said he wanted Brody to be more of like an average, you know, everyman, and that Charlton Heston was too big and too larger in life, and the audience would automatically know that he would survive the shark at the end of the movie.
Oh, okay. So we wanted to believe that Brody wasn't going to survive.
Yes.
I mean, it did look pretty bad at the end. Like, it was like, there's no way.
Yeah, it was looking pretty rough for Roy at the end of the movie, so. And he's right. Heston probably would have played it up to the point. I mean, this is around the same time that Heston did the Omega Man.
Yeah.
I mean, he was very, you know, very macho and bigger than life in that movie, so. The first day the model shark was used, it sank to the bottom of the ocean. It needed a great deal of maintenance and didn't appear very terrifying. Spielberg recalled, if I had no choice but to figure out how to tell the story without the shark, and he reasoned that it's what we don't see, which is truly frightening. So that's the reason he's filmed like the POV shots from then on out.
Nice.
Despite the film's mammoth box office returns, Robert Shaw did not earn a penny out of it because he was on the hook from the IRS for tax evasion, and the fact that they were filming in the U.S., got him on the hook with IRS, and they're like, buddy, you're going to prison if you don't hand over every bit of the money that this movie gave you. And so that's what he had to do.
Oh, man.
In addition to the well-known nickname of Bruce, Steven Spielberg also called the shark the Great White Turd because he was so frustrated with it not working. Richard Dreyfuss originally passed on the part of Hooper, saying that Jaws was a film that he would love to watch but not to make.
Wow.
I think there's trivia about why he decided, you know, to come back to it, but he originally did pass on it. The story that Quint tells about the experiences aboard a sinking cruiser is a fictionalized version of the actual World War II USS Indianapolis. Of the almost of the over 1,000 crewmen that were on board, only 316 survived. 300 died during the sinking, and 579 died from exposure, dehydration, drinking salt water, and some from shark attacks.
Oh,
so the biggest thing was is that most of the dialogue in that scene was written by Shaw himself,
okay.
Which is very impressive because if you're watching the movie, it gets to a lull at this scene, and you think, okay, you know, they're having a little bit of moment, a little bit of peace from the shark. Now, when he starts telling the story about how him and his men, he had to watch like his fellow soldiers get eaten like day by sharks.
Oh my God.
It's one of the darker parts in the fucking movie. Like, and the fact that he wrote that's pretty fucking amazing in my opinion. The ship actually sunk over a month later on July 30th instead of June 29th, 1945, despite, you know, what he said in the account. But otherwise, I mean, it was, you know, just embellishing that. 12 years after filming Jaws, Richard Dreyfuss began acting in the film Stakeout with co-star Emilio Estevez. Between filming scenes, they each quoted lines from movies. Estevez cleverly asked Dreyfuss to identify the film in which he utters, "There is no boat accident," and Dreyfuss didn't recognize it. This is no boat accident. And the amusing inside joke gets reenacted and appears in the actual movie because of the fact that Dreyfuss didn't even recognize his own line from his own movie.
That's so funny.
In the original novel, Hooper has an affair with Brody's wife and is killed by the shark in the cage at the end. However, because the relationship between Brody's wife and Hooper was considered by many to be irrelevant to the plot and arbitrarily included in the novel just to sex it up, they omitted it from the film, and even the author had to admit that the movie was better off because it gave the three main characters more time to establish their characters than he gave them in the novel.
Yeah, so, I like that.
The entire second half of Jaws takes place on the ocean with just Scheider, Shaw, and Richard Dreyfuss carrying it between the three of them. No other characters appear, and there's no dry land visible because Spielberg wanted everybody to feel claustrophobic and isolated, just like the characters would be. I think he did a pretty good job of getting that point across. When Universal saw the finished film and they were more than happy with the result, they began an advertising campaign on television that cost an unprecedented, at that time, $700,000 to advertise this movie. I mean, that's even a lot for now. Like, I mean, I think, like, the Marvel movies only get, like, a budget of, like, $300,000 on top of their bloated budgets to advertise. So Universal really went to the bat for this movie.
Yeah.
Dreyfuss was tested and cast at the suggestion of George Lucas, who had just worked with him on American Graffiti. Heston was so annoyed at being rejected for the role of Brody that he later made disparaging comments about Steven Spielberg and vowed to never work with him again. He later turned down Spielberg's offer of the role of General Stillwell in 1941. This worked out well for him, as 1941 was an embarrassing flop in all respects. So I guess his pettiness actually saved him from a bad movie. So there you go.
Wow.
As the shoot ballooned from 55 days to 159, with a budget likewise spiraling, the film earned the nickname amongst the crew of flaws. Steven Spielberg later reflected, "I thought my career as a filmmaker was over. I heard rumors that I would never work again because no one had ever taken a film 100 days over schedule."
Oh, my God.
And he was young. He was only 28 when he made this movie. Yeah. So, like, I mean, that would have been, I mean, a really bad thing for his first major movie to be, you know.
Yeah.
Director Steven Spielberg attributed many problems to his perfectionism and his inexperience. The former was epitomized by his insistence on shooting at sea with a life-size shark. "I could have shot the movie in a tank or even a protected lake somewhere, like I said. I was naive about the ocean, basically. I was pretty naive about Mother Nature and the hubris of a filmmaker who thinks he can conquer the elements. But I was too young to know I was being foolhardy when I demanded that we shoot the film in the Atlantic Ocean and not in North Hollywood tank." So,
God.
I mean, you live and you learn, I guess.
Yeah.
Most of the third act of the film was shot handheld, prompting Steven Spielberg to quip that Jaws was the most expensive handheld movie ever made.
Nice.
And the reason for that was they didn't have Steadicams back then. Yeah. So the boats that they were on trying to film the rickety, rocketing boat that the actors were on, both of them were moving side to side. So the director of photography had to get real creative, and he had to figure out a way to sway himself
yes.
with the camera so that it mimic so that he would get like a steady shot when it was all said and done.
Damn.
Murray Hamilton was the only star of Steven Spielberg's first choice and was the only actor of his choice that considered to play the role of the mayor of Amity. So he must have had that sleazy, you know, politician vibe about him enough that Spielberg was like, nope, you're the guy. Nobody else is going to be playing this part.
Yeah.
It was originally rated an R by the MPAA, but was trimmed down to PG after they literally just trimmed up a scene showing a severed leg by wow. a few frames.
From R to PG.
One scene took it from R to PG.
Yeah. And not even one scene. Some frames.
Frames of a scene, yeah. The other thing is, though, they didn't have PG-13 back then, so it might have been, it would have probably been a PG-13 movie if they would have had that rating. But, you know, whatever. PG-13 is kind of stupid, in my opinion. Don't really, I mean, has it ever deterred anybody from watching it? You yeah. know, that's, I mean, whatever. A real shark became entangled in a line that had been laid down over the underwater cage. This footage was subsequently used in the film.
That's kind of cool.
In the novel, it was revealed that Mayor Larry Vaughn is being blackmailed by the mafia to keep the beaches open. The mob had invested in Amity real estate and was hoping for multi-million-dollar sales. So that's the reason he's so gung-ho about keeping it open. It's because the mob's going to take him out.
Yeah.
They actually kicked the author off of this movie because between the fact that they wrote out the scene with Hooper having an affair with Brody's wife, and the fact that they were totally ignoring the mob aspect of the whole thing pissed him off. And they were just like, well, just get the fuck off the set because we're not doing that shit. And that's,
yeah.
He had to leave. So while John Milius is taking credit for writing the USS Indianapolis scene, Carl Gottlieb claimed he actually had a little to do with it, giving Robert Shaw the credit. According to Gottlieb, the only time the line Milius came up with that remains in the movie is earlier in the film when Quint tells the people Amity, I'll find him for three, but I'll catch him and kill him for 10, and that and everything else Shaw came up with. So there you go.
Yeah.
Body count in the movie is 8. There's 5 people, 1 dog, Rut-Row Raggy, and 2 sharks.
Hate this movie.
It won 3 of 4 awards it was nominated for at the Academy Awards, but lost Best Picture to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Really?
Yep. Quint's name came from the Latin word for fifth. Quint is the 5th person killed by the shark.
Oh!
That's why he's named that.
Oh, my God.
Spielberg despised how phony the shark prop looked, so he shot it from awkward angles beneath the water for only moments at a time, anything to keep the audience from getting a good look at it. It also kept breaking down, which resulted in lots of shots in the movie that imply the presence of the shark. Spielberg later said that much of the credit for this film goes to the film's editor, Verna Fields. They would fight in the editing room, Fields' pool house, over whether to use this trope, her preference, or to use a shot of the shark that Spielberg had spent a day capturing, so...
There was actually
some people after the fact that said Verna Fields was primarily the reason this movie was so popular as opposed to Spielberg anyways, because the editing was what saved the movie from what it could have been.
I would have to agree.
and they pointed out that it would have been like a schlocky B movie and not the amazing, you know, like cinematic masterpiece that everybody considers it to be if it wasn't for the fact that the editing was done the way it was. So Spielberg was initially apprehensive about hiring Roy Scheider, feeling that he would portray a tough guy similar to his role in The French Connection, but you know, he played a pretty good scared, you know, everyman who just trying not to die. So I mean good for him. Contrary to popular belief, the Jersey Shore attacks were not the inspiration for Peter Benchley, nor did they have a role in him writing the novel. Before his death, he corrected this numerous times. His inspiration for this movie was a photograph of a large great white shark caught by Frank Mundus, and he drew inspiration from that, wondering what it'd be like from an even bigger rogue great white terrorizing community. So, very similar to their characters. Like I said, Shaw, you know, taunted Richard Dreyfuss. I've already kind of mentioned that. The Orca was originally called, the Orca is the name of the boat that Shaw's going, you know. It was originally called the Warlock because, and incidentally, one of the stunt performers happens to be, was Dick Warlock, who was, you know, Michael Myers in the second you know, Halloween movie, but, you know, there you are. In the opening credits, Spielberg uses a distorted audio pickup of squawking birds over the Universal logo. This is a direct homage to the birds.
Nice. So
there you go. Early on, before development of Jaws as a feature film, it was started to be developed as a television series. They were going to have celebrity guest stars on each episode. Each new episode was going to have a new celebrity guest star getting eaten by the shark.
Oh my God.
That's what they were going to do before they turned it to a movie. The model featured on the vandalized Amity poster was Brian De Palma's girlfriend at the time.
Nice. So. And it lives on because it is still at Universal Studios.
A gag that is often overlooked by contemporary audiences is when Quint crushes a whole can of beer and then crushes the can in it, or he drinks it and then crushes the can in his hand. Hooper does the same thing with an easily crushed styrofoam cup. You could do that now. I mean, you know, it doesn't look like that big of a deal because we use aluminum cans, or aluminium, as the British would say. But back then, they actually used steel to make their beer cans. So tin and steel. So it took a lot to crush a fucking beer can back in those days.
Damn.
The license plate that Hooper removes from the shark's body has the number 007 on it. That is a reference to the fact that Steven Spielberg was wanting to try to film a James Bond film. And it's funny because Robert Shaw played the villain Red Grant in the movie From Russia with Love. Funnily enough, Sean Connery, Bond, and said film worked together with Roy Scheider years later in the Russia House. But I think what's funny about this, too, if you've ever seen the movie, and I love this group, Broken Lizards, Beer Fest, there's a scene where I'm trying to think of the character's name. It's the guy who plays Farva, but he plays a character that just eats and drinks everything. And one of the characters, and at his funeral in the movie, one of the other characters makes the comment that you would find like a license plate, you know, or if you cut into his belly, you'd find a license plate or a half chewed, you know, tire, you know, basically calling back Jaws, you know, because he would eat anything. So yeah. There you go. Farewell, Spanish Ladies is also the song that Robert Shaw's character Quint sings in the movie, is also sung in Moby Dick, just as the crew found out they were hunting the white whale. So that's kind of another tie to Moby Dick in this movie. Peter Benchley liked how cutting the subplots from the novel left the characters to be fleshed out properly, as I've said. Following the release of the film, interest in shark fishing soared. Imagine that.
Wow.
Yeah, people went to kill a bunch of sharks after this movie.
Ew.
This was the second horror film nominated for the Academy Award for Best Picture after Exorcist.
Wow.
I hate the fucking Academy. They never recognize horror as like legitimate, like anything. Again, he didn't win the year. It was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. He always considered Jurassic Park a sequel to Jaws, but on land. The people didn't necessarily agree with that, though, because they said that Jaws focused more on the characters and it felt like that Jurassic Park was mainly there just to have dinosaurs, you know, for merchandise reasons. So, which is pretty much true. I mean, everybody remembers the three main characters, you know, in Jurassic Park, you know, Malcolm and then, you know, Grant and Ellie, but like, they don't stand out as much as the three mains in this. Like it's, you remember the T-Rex more by a long shot and the Raptors. Island is actually Martha's Vineyard, as I've said. Quint's mannerisms were based on Craig Kingsbury, a local fisherman and eccentric. Kingsbury got a small role as Ben Gardner, who's later found underwater in the movie. He was originally hired to show the local dialect to Robert Shaw, a British man. Kingsbury ended up being, so he basically, the whole accent that Shaw has is from this guy. And Kingsbury ended up being hired to chat with Shaw for weeks, chatting about shark stories and anything else. A PA recorded everything, and some of the bits made into the script.
Reverend, hold on 1 second. We're getting some robot sounds. Oh, and you're back to normal now. Okay, sorry.
So anyways, going back to that, Kingsbury was hired to chat with Shaw for weeks to tell about shark stories and whatever. And some of his things that he told Robert Shaw at the time actually made it into the movie about how Great White's not like chasing a Tommy Cod or a bluegill in a pond.
Yeah.
And Steven Spielberg said Kingsbury was the purest version of who in his mind Quint was. So they basically made the character after the guy they hired, you know, locally. So yeah. There you go. Ew. In the early stages of the film, Chief Brody is seen looking through reference books on sharks. If you look closely enough, one of the sharks appears to have a scuba tank in its mouth.
Nice.
Which is how it dies in the movie. Foreshadowing. Spielberg's continual problems making the mechanical shark look and act real became an inadvertent blessing for the film because he was able to use the music and everything else. This actually, you know, worked to his benefit and made the movie more elevated and, you know, more piece of cinema than it would have been if he'd actually showed the shark constantly. Robert Shaw uses an M1 Garand rifle that Quint hands him, which is appropriate because Quint would have been a soldier during World War II, and that's what he would have used. If you know anything about those guns, the only reason I left this in here is whenever you shoot them 8 times, they've got like this one, and they call it an end block clip. It has a pinging sound. And during World War II, they would actually, like German soldiers knew that, so they would wait for that sound and then start shooting back. You know, knowing that that meant that somebody would have to take seconds to reload gun. If you watch in the movie and count, Brody has one bullet left. One bullet whenever he goes to shoot the shark.
Yeah.
Because of all the times that he's shot out
and
of
I
it.
I think he manually ejected one or something.
Yeah. Yeah, it says that he had to manually eject the cartridge for checking the rifle, missing a further 6 shots and finally hitting with a 7th, meaning he only had like 1 left or whatever.
Yeah.
As part of the marketing campaign for the movie's release, various shops were selling ice cream with flavors such as shark latte and vanilla.
Uh-uh.
Yeah. I mean, that kind of sounds like the kind of stuff they would do now. Yeah, it's kind of funny that they had that back then. Gene Hackman was actually considered for the role of Brody in the movie.
No.
35 years after this movie, Richard Dreyfuss made a cameo in Piranha 3D, reprising his character under the name of Matt Boyd, but wearing the same clothes as Matt Hooper. So, the theme or the voice of the shark plays in every scene. As a result, if you watch during the fake attack, you'll notice that the theme music doesn't play, which is a very pivotal point because it's not the actual shark, so you're not seeing.
Oh.
They don't use the music there.
Makes sense. That's why you're supposed to listen for the noise when you're in the water, so you know. You listen for the music, so you know when it's Jaws.
Yeah. Yeah. Makes a lot of sense. Steven Spielberg revealed that he used the orca boat for solo therapy sessions, and this is wild. It said that after he got done filming the movie, he was so stressed out and had so much anxiety and everything that, and by the way, his anxiety was made even worse because you know what he was sleeping on after he left that, that the ocean? The stupid bastard slept on a waterbed. So in his dreams, he was like, you know, still wobbling and waving because he was on a fucking waterbed, whatever. So he got to the point where he would like wake up with a sweat at 3 a.m, even up to 10 years later, because he was still dreaming that he was making the movie. It was like that, you know, bad, like he was having that bad of experience. He got through all this by literally going to the Universal Studios lot, getting on the boat because they had it there, and sit in the corner where Quint gave his Indianapolis speech and just kind of like, you know, live in the moment or whatever. And that helped him get through it. And in fact, it helped him get through other bad stuff that he had going through his lifetime. So he actually used that boat to like, you know, get back out of his, you know, like PTSD he had from the movie.
Yeah. Wow.
After Leave Marvin turned down the role of Quentin, Charlton Heston was rejected. Everyone settled on Sterling Hayden, but the actor was having IRS problems and stayed in France, which is funny because Robert Shaw was also having IRS problems, and that's why he didn't make money from it. So there you go. Steven Spielberg stood in the back of the theater during a preview screening in Dallas in March of 75, and according to Peter Biskin's book, Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, a man in the front row got up, broke into a run, alarmed Steven Spielberg, thought to himself, he must really hate this movie. The man went to the lobby, promptly threw up all over the carpet, went to the bathroom to clean himself up, went and sat back down, and then the director said that's when he knew that he had a hit on his hand.
That's a little excessive, but okay.
I'm telling you, people back in the day, I guess if your only exposure to horror movies up to that time was like those weird radioactive, like Gila monsters and the huge ants that were just regular ants, but like put over a miniature or something,
yeah,
then this movie might be that. I don't know. I grew up on worse stuff, so I don't know what to say, but you know, it is what it is. The Shark Is Broken is a Broadway play co-written by Ian Shaw, who is the son of Robert Shaw, and portrays the behind-the-scenes camaraderie, competition, and joking between the three main actors as they pass the time on the Orca set waiting for the mechanical shark to be repaired. Ian also plays his father in the Broadway production and turns in a very convincing portrayal, including a reenactment of the famous USS Indianapolis speech. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
It's not about the movie. It's about like the behind the scenes of the movie, which is kind of an interesting way to go about it, I guess.
Yeah.
Initially, the scene in which Quint is eaten alive was to be more bloody, but they couldn't put that in the final cut because that would have definitely put him over the PG rating. So, you know, they had to make it blood free when he got eaten alive. So there you go. The shark is named Bruce, as again, Steven Spielberg's lawyer, Bruce M. Raymer. Bruce, the animatronic shark prop, had soft set of teeth for sequences where it had to interact with actors and stunt performers, especially for the scene, you know, Quint dying at the end. So it had like soft little teeth that were like bendy, yeah, or whatever. So Cuban leader Fidel Castro praised, wow, this movie as a depiction of capitalism's disregard for human life.
Oh, shut up.
Prior to this, major films would open in one cinema, garnering word of mouth before general release. So basically, back in the day, now not only was the summer blockbuster, not a thing, but you released a movie, you maybe released it like, you know, one movie in like major city, you know, in each state, if you did that much.
Yeah.
This was the first movie where they just said, nope, put it in 460 theaters all at the same time and let it ride. And it did its thing. So. Kind of crazy that, yeah, movies were not, I mean, we're just used to how they are now.
But yeah.
I mean, the film is legendary for its many production problems. Like I said, the one cameraman had to compensate for the rock in the boat by resting the camera on his shoulders while he learned to basically shift and weave to make it stable looking. I don't even know how he did that, yeah, but whatever. At 28, Steven Spielberg was the youngest person to direct the film that opened at number one at the box office. He held that record for nearly 40 years until Josh Trank, who was 27 at the time, had a number one movie in the movie Chronicle.
Interesting.
When the boat Orca is leaving out of the harbor, there's a shot from Quint's window with a shark jaw put on it and the boat in the middle of it, foreshadowing the final fate of the Orca being devoured by the shark.
Nice.
Steven Spielberg had to deal with a fair amount of naysayers outside of those who made decisions concerning Jaws production, including one Hollywood actor who told him when they were 20 days behind schedule, everyone is talking about how you're never going to get a job after this movie because you're responsible for the budget. This actor was so sure I would never work again, they didn't care if they told me that, Spielberg says of the demoralizing comment. It was a very mean thing, by the way, to do. Looking back five decades on, Spielberg saw the bigger picture and felt the pride. As he explains in Jaws at 50, to me, Jaws was a life-altering experience. On the one hand, it was a traumatizing experience for me that was mostly about survival, and I think all of us feel like we survived something, he continues, and I just hope that all the people who worked on Jaws wore that experience proudly like a badge of honor.
Aww.
So. Charlton Heston truly wanted the role of Chief Brody, but he did end up working, surprisingly, with Roy Scheider on a special appearance on the TV show Sequest 2032. And then Scheider starred and Spielberg produced on that one. And they both passed away in 2008, barely 2 months apart. Roy Scheider and Charlton Heston did, which is, wow, really weird.
Hold on. There is, okay, it was called C-Lab 2021, but I saw the Sequest 2032.
I thought the same thing, okay, because I used to watch that show on Adult Swim. So
I used to love C-Lab.
Other people that were considered for the role of Hooper was John Voight,
oh my God,
Dustin Hoffman, Jan Michael Vincent, Kevin Klein, Don Scardino, Charles Grodin, which would have been really bad, and Erland Josephson. And then Josephson said, I would rather have intellectual battles with Liv Ullmann than fighting with some shark. So I guess he didn't partake to that.
Maybe Dustin Hoffman is the only person I could think of.
He would be the one that I would think of that. Because Boyd, I mean, he kind of got his chance to be like a Quint type character in the movie Anaconda. Mm-hmm. And, boy, that was a wild fucking movie. Kevin Kline, I don't know. Hooper has, to me, he has to be a little bit more, he has to have a little bit of a aggravating, like, nudge to him. To kind of, I mean, not like, I mean, he, Dreyfuss plays him likable enough, but he's got, like, I mean, and I feel like Kevin Kline was too nice at the time to really pull that character off. Yeah. So I don't know. Let's see. The scene where the three actors drunkenly sing Show Me the Way to Go Home struck an unexpected prison amongst, which we've discussed before. That's that, you know, where you have that feeling of, like, goosebumps from hearing, like, music. It struck an unexpected moment of frisson with many of the crew members who were all nearing the end of the rope at the stage in Trouble production. They were all basically fed up, and the song Show Me the Way to Go Home was just like, yeah, that. We're done. We want to go. Like, stop. Believe it or not, there will soon be a Jaws musical on Broadway, and it's not a parody. It's called Bruce, the Jaws theme musical. It actually covers the making of Jaws and has musical interludes and ballads with all the characters. Let's see. Robert Shaw initially turned on the role of Quint as he didn't care for the material, but given the fact he owed money to the IRS, and he was hoping for a reworking of the Brief Encounter movie that he had, you know, had in development hell, he tried to get it, you know, he thought that might be his way of getting back to that. Sadly, he died 3 years later before he ever got to even film that movie. So,
yeah,
there you go. This was the highest grossing horror film for over 20 years until it was surpassed by, of all things, The Sixth Sense.
Wow.
So there you go. Metalcore band Ice Nine Kills was inspired by this movie and wrote Rocking the Boat about it. The song used lines directly from the movie, which is what they usually do in their songs.
Oh, yeah, so. I was about to say, yeah, that's the thing, like a work of art. Come on, we know what that is. There's another one. I think it's Hip to Be Scared. And
yeah, that's American Psycho.
American Psycho, yes. It's one of my favorite. I like how it has a little hip to be square.
The thing is about Ice Nine Kills, I've got a couple of people that I know that are really into them, and I like them all right, and you'd think that I'd really like them. I mean, I've had people say that because they're, you know, horror element, and I do, but the thing is I don't like screamy type music, and when the guy sings, he can sing really well, the lead singer of Ice Nine Kills, but then he goes to the, you know, just does that, and I don't like that stuff. I just don't like how it sounds.
I have to agree with you. I am not too much into screamy. I think their screamy is as very little in comparison that you actually probably could enjoy a concert because it's just not a ton. But the reason why I have not gone to see them is because they are always playing with why can't I think of them right now? A huge, they did, why can't I think? Hold on. I feel so dumb. You're gonna laugh when you're like, you couldn't remember them. I'm having such a hard time with my phone right now too. It keeps like disappearing. Everything I'm trying to do, like it keeps going away. It's so on the tip of my tongue. You're gonna die. Fuck.
What's their music that you're trying to think of?
Master of Puppets. I finally remembered the name.
Okay. That's the band name, Master of Puppets?
No. The song.
Metallica?
Yes, Metallica. That's why I said you're going to be like, what the fuck? They're always playing with Metallica, and I do not want to go see Metallica.
Oh, I don't blame you on that. Like,
they're so played out.
This dates me quite a bit, but I saw Metallica at like this summer event that they did back like in the late 90s or whatever. Real good concert. I mean, it had Kid Rock and Joe C, you know, whenever he was still with him.
Yeah.
Had Power Man 5000. Ooh. Had... who else did it? I want to say Korn might have been there. It was like it was several bands, and Metallica was like the last band that played that evening. Well, the thing was, is like they didn't show up at that event because, you know, the main James had like went on a skiing trip, which is so metal, you know, he was skiing. broke his leg and he couldn't make it there. So they said that they would comp the tickets and come back whenever they came back to Rupp Arena, like later on, and we went there. Well, it was like, I mean, Rupp Arena sucks. I anybody who has any other opinion can go fuck themselves, like as far as like watching artists, because it's good for basketball games, but it's not like lined up to where you can actually see the stage that well.
Oh, yeah.
And we were up in the nosebleeds anyways, and like the couple behind us had just got some ice cold beer and they dumped it down our backs. So like it was a whole bad experience. But all that happened before the whole Napster and, you know, Lars acting like a fucking tool over it. So I was fine with Metallica at the time, but I wouldn't go pay to see them. So I totally understand that now.
Yeah, it's so funny. We were offered basically our tickets paid for to go see Limp Bizkit, Ice Nine Kills, and Metallica. And granted, it was well in the middle of me moving. You know the story.
Yeah.
And we seriously considered it. We're like, we would love to see Ice Nine Kills and Limp Bizkit. But
oh, yeah, both those bands, I'd love to see them. Even if Fred Durst has that weird white fro that he's, you know, he's going rocking with now. But
I know. And I was like, man, so we thought about it. And I was like, we can always leave during Metallica.
That's true.
And it's just so sad to have to think that way, you know? Anyways.
Well, and I've told this several people, they fucked up as a band with Saint Anger, and it just went south from there. Like, they've not had good music, to my opinion, since then, but whatever. but yeah, if Ice Nine Kills had less of the screamy, I'd be fine with it, because, like I said, that's the reason I like the Art of Dying, or whatever the name of it is, you know, about Terrifier, because when he sings really well in that song. He's only got a few lines that are screamed in that one, so it's not too bad. But some of the ones that he did, like the Jason one, there's one for like Camp Crystal Lake, he screams through most of it, and I did not like that one.
Oh, okay.
So, but The Hip to Be Scared, now that's a good one,
that's
too.
That's a good one.
So,
I like that one, yeah.
When Brody is flipping through a shark book at night, he comes across the photo of a man with severe shark bites on his torso. This was Rodney Fox, an Australian, who was probably the most famous shark bite victim in the world until recent years. Rodney was also one of the experts enlisted by Spielberg's team to help photograph actual great whites in Australia, attacking a model of Matt's shark cage to be spliced in with the Bruce shots back home. So,
wow.
You'll like this. The Cocker Spaniel seen at the edge of the shots in Brody's home was Spielberg's own dog, Elmer, who would appear in several of his films. So.
Certified good boy.
In the original script, Quint was killed off by drowning. The rope from the harpoon that he fires at the shark wraps around his foot and pulls him and is pulled under by the shark. And he's calling for Brody to give him the knife. This was the way the character was cut off in the book. And according to an interview with Spielberg about the scene, it was similar to the way that Ahab dies in Moby Dick. However, it was decided that Quint should be eaten because that would be the most tragic way for him to die, given the fact that he had that whole spiel about the USS Indianapolis and having to watch his fellow, you know, soldiers get eaten. And, like, you know, what a terrible way for him to die. And,
It
really was the best way in the movie for him to go out. Before the shark was blown up at the end, an explosives expert with a blasting permit was needed. Richard S. Edwards had done extensive explosives work while working for the Navy and then for the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. He agreed to place the dynamite for the final scene. Finding he couldn't get past the teeth of the shark's mock-up, he was forced to crawl into the back of the device, but it was made of sharp fiberglass. After wrapping his knees with towels and putting on heavy gloves, he had to carry the dynamite in his mouth to place it in the head of the shark where the picture was taken, and now is in the archives of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, along with oral history that describes his contribution to the classic movie. He had a stick of dynamite in his fucking mouth, crawling through fiberglass. Preview audiences didn't scream when the head of the shark victim appears in the hole in the bottom of the boat. The first big response was for the sharks appearing when Brody is chumming, which is the scariest moment in the movie, honestly.
Yeah.
Spielberg said that he got greedy and wanted to scream for the earlier sequence. He reshot the scene and editor Verna Field's swimming pool numerous ways to finesse the moment, then found that the chumming scene got less of a scream, which he eventually realized was because the audience didn't trust him and was worried about what might come next. So less is more.
Yes.
And that is all the trivia that I have for this. So I know that's a lot, but there was even more than that, and I had to cut a bunch of it. I'm just like, all right, there's a point, you know, that we have to stop this. This is one of those horror movies that if you don't – I have a hard time with any horror fan that says they hate this movie, because I don't know how you hate it, but this is one of the best horror movies that's ever made. It really is. It's the best – when animals attack movie for sure. Like, there's no debate in my mind. I mean, this is a 5 out of 5 for me. I mean, this, the everything come together, the actors, the music, Spielberg's direction in the movie, the way that they set everything up, the foreshadowing, the whole scene with Quint, you know, whenever he's like talking about the USS Indianapolis, like, you don't get any better than fucking Jaws when it comes. I mean, there's a reason why all those movies like Orca, Alligator, Crocodile, like on and on and on, even like movies years later, like Anaconda and Deep Blue Sea came out the way they did, was because of this movie, you know? So there's nothing I can add to it. I mean, in the fact, you know, what I enjoyed about the movie, and I'm going to tell you, that scene with Quint, when he's delivering his lines, you know, about the USS Indianapolis, to me, that and the scene where Brody is chumming the waters and the shark appears are the two best in the movie for me, just because of they actually encapsulate the actual horror element of the movie better than anything else in it, in my opinion. So
I would say my two favorite scenes, if we're going to point out two, because we don't normally do that, but my two favorite scenes, I sound so echoey right now. There it goes. Okay. This fucking microphone is so sensitive. The cage, underwater cage scene.
Oh God, that's pretty good too.
That's a good one. You can't deny. And then of course, when he's biting the tip of the boat. And eating Quint.
Quint's, and then he's slowly sliding down through there, and he's begging, you know, Brody to help him. Oh, that's so bad.
That sucks. Yeah, but I was like, the underwater cage scene, I'm like, he's gonna fucking get you. I was like, no, Bruce.
And you never feel safe for Hooper, even after that, even when the shark goes away from him, because you don't know it, for the longest time, you don't know if he's, you know, is ever going to be able to swim out and not get attacked.
Oh,
you know,
definitely.
Like, and how much air does he have? He's probably going to die down there, you know?
Exactly. the thing about great whites is I never really understand when they actually eat a person, because most sharks are opportunistic hunters. Meaning, you know, when they're hungry and whatever's in the area. And they say that most of the time people just get bitten because they're test bites. And then they're like, they don't like the taste of human flesh. So Bruce was a certified bad boy.
there was one of the trivias that I cut out, was somebody gave the writer shit over that. They were like, you realize that sharks do not act like this. They do not go out of their way to attack like this. You're totally painting them. And he's just like, listen, it's fictional. I can do what the fuck I want with it. So, you know.
Exactly. And the thing is, okay, do you remember the movie Orca? I don't even know if we put that on the list to watch that this season. But
we didn't. I don't know if I don't think I've ever seen it, to be honest. So
basically, in a nutshell, a orca whale is caught. And when they gut it, a baby comes out. And apparently the dad whale is watching while this is happening. Witnesses everything, goes on a tirade. That makes sense. Whales are typically smart. Dolphins are smart. And they will do things like that. So that movie made sense why this whale went on a killing spree. But as for Jaws, I'm not taken away from Jaws at all. I love this movie. This is a great movie. This movie had me screaming. Like, literally, I was watching just kind of like a movie clips to kind of like catch up, because it's been a month or two since I've seen it.
Yeah.
And I'm screaming so bad. My dog is jumping on my lap, panicking. And my boyfriend and my kids come out of the rooms like, is everything okay? It's like, I'm just watching the movie. But anyways, aside from that, we get it. Like, that's not how sharks usually are. I guess as part of me would kind of want, like, why did this shark do it? Did somebody kill its shark baby, its shark family?
Well, you know what's funny about that? I think it might be, it's either Jaws 2 or Jaws 3. It's the opposite of what you just said. Because this shark was killed, the family of the shark decides to go not just on a revenge mission, but it goes specifically after the Brody family, because it knew that Brody killed its, you know, its family member. So it goes after Brody's family,
which is insane.
That's absolutely insane. But that's what they set up in some of the sequels.
Because sharks are not smart like killer whales or dolphins.
No, I mean, and just but I mean, you got just just the way the movie was filmed and everything else, like there is so much tension set up throughout the movie.
Yeah.
Like even the false moments of tension, like the scene where, I mean, this is not one of my top scenes, but it's a good one. When Hooper is there, he's out at night with Brody, mm-hmm. and he's going to go down there to see what happened with that one boat. And then he sees that head or whatever, like you're waiting the entire time for that shark to eat him. You're like, don't go in the water. Don't go in there, you motherfucker. And like, and he's like, you know, and he's swimming around and you get like little, you hear a little bit of the shark's theme start playing. You're like, oh my God, get the fuck out of that water. You know, like the whole movie's like that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's very well set up. So
there is nothing about this movie, the acting, the storyline, the music, the scenery. There's nothing about this movie that I can say they needed to fix this.
It truly is one of those movies that, I mean, I've upgraded this movie like four times in my physical media. So now I have the 50th anniversary Steelbook version of it with mm-hmm. the great 4K that they came out with. And it's got this big, long documentary, Jaws at 50, that's an extra disc in there. If they come out with anything better, I'd probably upgrade again. But that's the one movie that, I mean, one of the few movies that I'd be like, oh, yeah, give me more. Like,
yeah.
This one of those good movies, you know.
Definitely.
So, I mean, nothing else to say about it. I mean, you know, surprise, it's a 5 out of 5. It's a perfect, it's pretty much a perfect movie. Like there's not, like she's like, you know, Urania said, there's nothing to add to it. I mean, mm-mm. You can't sit there and do like armchair, you know, director or producer on this one, because what are you going to change that's going to make it any better? Like nothing. You know?
Yeah. They did a great job. The editing has to be amazing. I've even seen pictures of Bruce outside of editing, obviously. And yes, you can see where he's mechanical, but I still think he looks amazing.
Yeah, I mean, they did a good job even, I mean, you know, especially with the editing, but just the shark itself, like, I mean, I think they don't give themselves enough credit. Yeah, it might have looked fake, like, you know, face on, mm-hmm. you know, like in the light of day, but there's a lot of stuff you do in movies to kind of cover that up. I mean, hell, Jason Voorhees, like, you know, the makeup that they had in, like, say, Part 7, which wasn't the best movie ever, but the makeup was amazing as far as, like, Undead Jason. If you saw that in the light of day, it would probably look like shit, too. It's the lighting, it's the way that it's filmed. I mean, like, there's all these other things. So, I mean, you can't be too perfectionist about it, just seeing it up front, because you have to, you know, anticipate, like, well, how's it going to be filmed? How's it going to look on film? You know, that's the bigger, you know, thing. So,
I could not imagine working in the water with that shark. I would not enjoy that at all. That would not be fun. I know it's a movie. I don't even know how they did the ocean scenes, because they're trying to say that Jaws was on some kind of motorized underwater lift, kind of like an underwater roller coaster, if you will.
Yeah.
And that's what made him move. And I'm like, but how did they do that in the ocean where it looked like there was lots of, I can understand a man-made lake, but like the ocean, it's off the Atlantic. That's why. I don't know how they did that. But like, there's other sharks in the fucking Atlantic. There's that. And this reminds me of when I sent you that, those pictures of what I called the real life of Neptune, of that zombie shark. Well, not zombie shark. What? Wasn't alive, but it's a shark that's like, I know what you're talking about.
It's like kept over in some kind of abandoned amusement park mm-hmm. or something. And yeah.
And they're trying to like restore it, and they're in the water with it. Oh
yeah. So it's extremely nasty. Yes.
I cannot do that. I know.
Listen, I took this out of the trivia, but the production crew was so fed up with everything that they gave word to Steven that the last day of filming, they were going to throw him in the ocean. They were going to do it. He got them back by setting up all the shots they needed, like lining up the, you know, the cameras and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing that they were going to do it, you know, if he was still there, he said, start filming. And he walked off set, got on a plane with Richard Dreyfuss. Richard Dreyfuss looked over him and said, what do you do? He's like, how's the movie? And he's like, I don't know. They're filming it right now. And he's like, what do you mean? He's like, they were going to throw me in the water. I just told them to fucking shoot it. And then I left. And they both had a nice laugh as they were flying away from the place.
Flying over the scene.
Yeah. So the movie was that terrible for everybody that they were just like, fuck it. We just want it over with.
That's hilarious. Anyways. All right.
Well, hopefully this has been, you know, entertaining for the people who decide to listen to this after our long, you
our
know,
hiatus,
unplanned
yes.
hiatus. But, you know, life happens. Unlife happens.
Unlife happens. Yeah, afterlife happens. And you know what? If you're joining us again, if you've been waiting, if you've been wondering what's going on, we are so sorry. We're back. And we plan on continuing this as we used to. This season will be a lot shorter, obviously, since we've missed a few months. So the Reverend and I will be going through our list and updating as necessary and going from there.
Yeah, probably hitting the highlights because I think at this point it's kind of needed. So
definitely.
All right, folks. With that, peace be with you.
And with your spirit.